This is Mythogynist, where I host long-form conversations with the most interesting women you've never heard of. Allison Jean Cole is a lapidary artist and geology enthusiast who has dedicated her life to rock hounding, Antarctic stone cutting, and traveling the remote deserts of the Pacific Northwest to better study its geologic history. Allison spends her time between a studio and rock club in Portland, Oregon, kicking up dust chasing waypoints in her lifted 4Runner, leading expeditions and soaking in geothermal hotspots along the way. In this conversation, we discuss finding massive tortoise bones from 45 million years ago, theories on the largest impact craters, lapidary arts, flood basalt theory, and how some of the best mysteries of the Earth present themselves in the form of rocks and minerals. Allison is sharp, sassy, and fun, and she knows a hell of a lot about geologic history of the Northwest. Like the stones she cuts, this conversation is a gem. Enjoy. Hey, Allison, welcome to Mythogynist.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so pleased you're here. So one of the things I wanted to just start, I always ask people what they've been up to for the last week or so. How have you been spending your time?
I have been cutting rocks. I have been setting up a new stone sculpture situation in my backyard involving pneumatic tools, and I've been gardening.
Oh, wow. All of those sound like great projects.
They are. And the global pandemic, which has caused us all to stay at home, has been largely responsible for my time to be able to do those things.
Right. Yeah. Everyone's living a slightly different lifestyle.
Very much so.
And what part of the world are you living in, Allison?
My girlfriend and I live in Southeast Portland in Oregon.
Oh, wonderful. How long have you been in Portland?
I've been here for a decade.
Ah, all righty. So you didn't grow up there?
No, I'm an East Coast transplant. I grew up in a colonial New England family.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings about it.
I always tell people that I'm also from the East Coast, and I always tell people that I'm a recovering East Coaster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the white culture on the East Coast is very, very type A, kind of fast-paced, and that never quite felt natural to me. But also I struggle a little bit with the colonial heritage part. There's a lot of pride in my family about our family history. And I understand the roots of that pride, but I also think that there's a big part of that story missing.
Yeah, no kidding.
So I don't know. It's not why I moved west, but now that I've lived west for 10 years, I feel a little bit blindsided by it all.
Yeah, once you've sort of stepped outside of it, I imagine it's a much different perspective.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and moving west and spending a lot of time in and around indigenous land with healthy, beautiful indigenous populations, which is not something that exists in New England, was a real eye-opener for me. Even Portland has a really vibrant indigenous community. There's a lot of various tribal groups that call Portland home, and they live here and they have a presence here. And then once you get out into desert landscapes, then those communities are very, very visible.
And so to give people a sense of how it is that you're making it out to these desert landscapes, will you tell us a little bit about what it is to be, is it a lapidary? Is that the word you would use?
Yep, I'm a lapidary or a lapidary artist. That is the craft of cutting small scale stones for jewelry, boxes, trinkets, adornment, etc.
Yeah, wow. And your work is amazing. If anyone who's listening, I encourage them to go check out the website. It has so many beautiful pieces on there. I mean, things that I didn't think were possible with stones, to be honest. I've never seen anything like it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I definitely am lucky in that I have my own very distinct style of stone cutting. It's called intarsia, which is a style of inlay. It's where you fit small pieces of stone together to make kind of a larger result. And so far it's stayed kind of unique in the world of jewelry, which has been very fortunate for me.
How did you come across that style, or how did it develop?
Oh, you know, that I don't know how to answer that question because I haven't really thought back on too much of it. I think my current style, the best answer I could give, is a culmination of successful experiments in about 7 years of a lot of not successful experiments. I know that when I started cutting stones, I wasn't piecing stone together. I was just cutting a singular stone into a singular shape. But over time, I really wanted to start gluing rocks together. And so I slowly worked through a lot of rock gluing experiments, and some of them started to work.
I guess that's a perfect beginning.
And so now I am a professional rock gluer.
So tell us a little bit about the process. So basically, I wrote down, which I'm not sure I fully understand what all of it means, but I'll let you explain it. But the idea that you take large chunks of rocks, and then with rock slabs, you put them on a slab saw and trim them to smaller pieces on what's called a trim saw. And then use a flat lap wheel, which is like a grinding wheel to help it make shape. Is that? I just said a bunch of words. Will you just tell me what I just said? What does that mean?
Yeah, let's walk through it. So rocks are hard, and you need the right tools to cut them down so that they become workable. So just like in wood, wood is processed very intensely through a lot of stages to get into the various shapes that people who do woodworking end up buying them in. There's not a lot of pre-processing in the rock world. And so what a lot of rock hounds or lapidaries have to do is invest in their own processing equipment. So I have a large saw that runs in a reservoir of oil and it has a big hood over it. I clamp a pretty large rock into a vise. So for me, the largest rock that I can cut is about the size of a football.
Oh, wow.
If I were to inherit a rock bigger than that, I would either have to break out some pretty serious tools or have somebody who has very, very large industrial tools break that rock down for me. So in my slab saw, which is a saw that makes slabs of a rock or slices, imagine sliced bread. You're taking that football sized rock and you're cutting it up just like sliced bread. I put the rock in the vise, I close the hood, I hit the switch, and a half an hour later, I have one slice of rock.
Oh, wow.
But from those slices, that's what lapidary artists start with. And those are called slabs. And there's something called a trim saw, which is a much smaller saw. My trim saw has a 6-inch blade. All lapidary tools have to be either diamond coated or diamond impregnated. Diamond serves as a harder abrasive material that can work against the rock that you're cutting. So all rocks will be softer than diamond, and therefore diamond is the ideal cutting surface to break through rocks. And so lapidary equipment can get kind of expensive too. So you really, really have to learn how to take care of your tools. Otherwise, you're going to be burning through a lot of cash. But the trim saw is a small saw that I stand in front of. It runs in a pool of lubricant. It's a water and a biodegradable base lubricant that I used. And it works just like a tile saw. So if any of you have ever done home improvement projects where you've used a tile saw, a trim saw is just the same. It's just a tiny bit fancier and more specific in some cases for cutting finer gemstones. And after I get the rough shape out of the slab that I want on the trim saw, say if I was going to make something a circle, I would kind of cut out an octagon shape. And then I would take that circular piece to my flat lap, which is a flat grinding wheel. So instead of a wheel that spins at me, it spins flat like a pancake, and I put the stone on it and I grind it down. And the discs on the flat lap change out successive grits. So I start with a really rough diamond disc and I work my way up through successive grits to a fine polish. And it takes a very long time. It takes a very long time. So that is a detailed breakdown of the process. And in between, I do some gluing.
And so when you're starting with the larger chunks and turning them into the rock slabs, is that a pretty physically demanding process?
You know, it's not so physically demanding because the slab saw does all the work for me. So I just have to very carefully put the rock into the vise. The vise grip grabs the rock and holds it in place. And that vise actually sits on a rod that's threaded. And what that does is once I close it, the motor turns a gear which grabs onto the threaded rod, and it literally just pushes the vise forward into the blade and eventually past it. And once it goes past it, the slab falls off. And so I just put it in the vise, make sure it's not going to slip, and I close the hood and I press the switch. And it's very loud and very slow, but I just get to stand and wait. The part that's really hard on my body is actually the grinding, the fine detail work, because I'm putting a lot of pressure on my finger joints, which are kind of fragile because I'm a little bit of a feathery, I'm of a feathery composition, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's a great description. What a great way to describe oneself. And so you were part of the Mount Hood Rock Club in Portland. Is that where you learned how to use the machinery? And what was the process like when you first became acquainted with it? I imagine it would be fairly intimidating.
Yeah, so I joined the Mount Hood Rock Club specifically so I could learn how to cut rocks. I think I joined 7 years ago, maybe eight, but I think, yeah, almost eight years ago now. And they have a club shop for all the members. And so it's this great little shop with every little rock cutting tool you could ever want to use. And their members there teach rock cutting. But they don't do it formally. There's no structured classes. There's no signups. You just join the club and you show up at the shop and everyone's kind of working and making stuff. And if you don't know how to use the equipment, they give you a very quick run through, scare you into treating the tool with a little bit of respect so you don't ruin it. And then you're on your own. So, wow. But one of the nice things about learning that way actually was that once you get the basic hang of the tool, you're constantly around other people who are better at it than you. And so you can always get advice because there's always other folks in the shop who have been cutting rocks for years and they're working. And so it was kind of an ideal learning situation for me. Lots of mentors.
That's an important process for anyone to have, to be an eternal student and always have those mentors.
Oh, sure. I'm always learning, and I'm still to this day, I'm always calling people up in my rock club, trying to get tips and advice on how to do things. For me, it's not so much cutting rocks and carving and shaping techniques that I'm calling up for advice now, but I feel like I'm starting to get into the point in my career where I need to become a lot more clever about maintaining and fixing my tools and investing in kind of more serious tools. And so that's where my club members really come through for me, is helping me not feel so frightened of these very large, scary pieces of equipment. So that's been nice. They've been a great resource. I love them.
Oh, how wonderful. And are most of the other people in the rock club, do they do jewelry work as well, or do they do other things with the rocks?
You know, I think the majority of people in the club do some sort of jewelry work. At the very basic level, there's just even like a lot of wire wrapping and beading that happens, all the way up mm-hmm. through like very advanced lapidary work where people are doing exquisite jade carving, or they're faceting high-end gemstones, or they're making larger lapidary things like clocks and boxes and chess sets. There's also a lot of people in my club that don't do any jewelry work. They just love collecting rocks. And so that's the real aim of the club, is to get out and collect rocks and minerals. And then I think that the lapidary hobby is just kind of like a natural evolution for most club members.
And so did you have a background in geology, or where did your fascination with rocks begin?
I think I've always had a mild fascination with rocks. When I was a little kid, I had a rock collection that I was really proud of. Nothing that I had found, but rocks that had been gifted to me or that I bought at, you know, like museum gift shops and stuff. And when I moved west, I was making jewelry kind of on the side for fun and was looking for a very specific shaped stone bead and couldn't find it anywhere. And I kind of became obsessed with willing this specific shaped bead into existence, and got turned down by so many stone cutters who wouldn't cut it for me because I wouldn't pay them enough. And eventually somebody turned me on to the Mount Hood Rock Club and said, why don't you just make this bead yourself? And so I joined the club so that I could make this bead, and then it transformed my entire life.
Oh, wow.
I do have a background in the sciences, but it's not in geology. It's in marine and freshwater sciences.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so kind of an accident. After college, I spent some time working in marine sciences, and I discovered that I get tremendously seasick, so I couldn't do any at-sea research. And I discovered that I didn't really like working in large institutions. I worked for two museums, and I just found myself really frustrated with the overworked and chronically underpaid model. It didn't seem worth my time to be making barely minimum wage for full time while conducting science with no chance for upward mobility, like, at all. I think I went through a phase in my 20s of feeling really disillusioned with the actual economic reality of what it's like to work in the sciences.
Yeah, that's kind of a tough position. I mean, it sounds like if someone, for the love of the project, wants to work on something, it would be worthwhile. But as a career move, it doesn't seem like a ton of incentive. And then without it being your career, you don't really have the resources and the tools and the institution behind you to get you access, you know, so it's kind of a catch-22.
Yeah, for sure. I think if you wanted to stay purely in research and you're willing to stay in academia your entire life, then it's probably worthwhile for a lot of people. But to stay in academia means you don't really have a lot of choice in where you end up. It's whatever posting you land, you're lucky to get, and that's where you go. And I really wanted to have some agency and choice in where I ended up. And so I decided to become a bartender.
All right.
I was bartending for a long time, and I made so much more money than I made when I was working for museums or as a researcher.
Where were you bartending? What area were you living in at the time?
I did some in Boston. And then when I moved to Portland, I did it here for about 6 years. And it was fun. And I made so many great friends and definitely had kind of like a funny, weird, pointless 20s, you know, like definitely not making any career advancements. But I was surviving and I was paying my rent and I was putting some money aside, and I got the first half of my day was so leisurely. Get up late, read the newspaper, go for a bike ride. If it's warm out, go swimming, cook some food, and then go to work, you know? But I think eventually that did get old, and I started realizing that I wouldn't be satisfied with that life for much longer.
What did you do next?
I think that's where the Mount Hood Rock Club came in. I think that maybe I didn't realize how much I needed, quote unquote, purpose and craft and an art practice in my life. And so when I started cutting rocks, I was just so in love, and I thought it was so fun. And I had so much free time in my life at the moment that I just dove totally into it. Within a month, I had, you know, saved all my tip money and bought all the equipment I needed, set up a little studio in the crappy garage at the house I was living in with some friends. And it was the only thing I did for like the first year, just like nonstop. It was the only thing I cared about. I was totally obsessed. And it was totally coincidental. Like I was just trying to get a bead made, you know?
Right.
So yeah, it was it was just so lucky for me. I didn't realize that I was lost, you know, but I think that when I look back on it, I was kind of lost in the world for a little bit there.
So tell me a little bit about going out and looking for rocks, what that process is like, and how that feeds your spirit and brings you meaning.
Oh, it's so fun. It's just the best. I remember the first few rock counting trips I went on with the Mount Hood Club. We went out to the Eastern Oregon deserts to a few locations, and, you know, we drove these hellish, high clearance, sketchy Forest Service roads and cattle ranching roads to these really remote locations, you know, and the whole time I was thinking, oh my God, how are we going to get out of here? Are we ever going to get back to civilization? Like, we are out there. But the places we ended up collecting rocks, the rocks were really cool. And I was really excited to make stuff out of what we collected. But the thing that really struck me the most was how extraordinary these places were that we were going to that I would have never otherwise gone to because they're not on the map, so to speak. They're not tourist destinations under any means. They're not easily accessible. And within just a few trips with my club through Central and Eastern Oregon, I discovered this whole new world of really wild, scenic geology, like places where you could really see the earth moving and the earth happening. And being someone from the East Coast, where the whole earth is covered with vegetation, you don't really get to see geology that way. And so this was one of my first times really witnessing very like textbook geology. And it was so exciting. And I just became hooked. I was hooked.
How magical.
Yeah, pure magic, the magic of the earth. And so I think for me, that was a really life-affirming, I can't call it a moment. It was a moment in time, but it lasted, you know, about a year of me really getting into this hobby and this craft. But it was a very life-affirming moment. I realized that, you know, once again, we're just a blip, a speck in geologic time, and that I didn't need to put so much emphasis on the meaning of my own life, but that really the whole purpose is that if you have the privilege of living in a safe part of the world, that you should do everything you can to enjoy your time in it. And so I think I, from that moment, I really decided I wanted to devote myself to this world of rocks and rock collecting and rock making. And I quit my bartending job and I took a leap of faith. I had no reason to like no financial reason to do that. But I just thought if I can make enough jewelry out of this stuff that I'm collecting and sell it, then I will have enough money to keep going out on these trips.
Sure.
So, and at the time, you know, I didn't have a family. I was single. So it was okay for me just to dive headlong into that pure, I just want to go outside and play. How can I make this happen for myself mission?
I loved your comment about realizing that we're just a blip in geologic time and how that can be life affirming. There seems to be, I've often tried to reconcile, like wrestled with this concept of being, you know, so much in our life, we toil to be of significance. We want to matter. We want to be loved. We want to be socially accepted, we want to be appreciated, whether that's through our job or social media or just in our community, whatever that means. And we're constantly trying to find this like meaning and purpose, and feeling so insignificant can be very painful. But something about the outdoors, all of a sudden that same smallness is all of a sudden a freedom instead of a kind of something to grieve. So all of a sudden it becomes something that's, yeah, more freeing and actually kind of something to be joyful about. And there's this, at least for me, sort of an emotional letdown of it's okay to be small. In fact, that there's some beauty in that. And it kind of feels like it lets me off the hook metaphysically in some or existentially in some way.
Yes, yes, yes. That is such a wonderful observation. I think that when we're at home and when we're in culture, I find myself feeling very powerless and very insignificant in the face of, you know, humanity's evil, aka corporations, you know, and some politicians and the amount mm-hmm. of power that they hold. And my girlfriend Lisa is somebody who's extremely passionate about climate change and conservation. And I think I watch how much the lack of inaction around those issues from the people who have the power to do something about it is so painful for her. And it is painful for me, but I don't think it's as painful for me because I feel like I'm constantly gripped by geologic time. And I'm constantly reminded that no matter what damage humanity does, ultimately the crust of the earth will swallow up humanity and destroy them and come to an eventual balance before the sun fades out and the earth cools enough that it no longer has, you know, weather or an atmosphere or surface life, and then it's done. And I find solace in the idea that eventually, like, corporations, I know I shouldn't just say like corporations, I should say humanity, but I like the idea of this, of them just getting like swallowed up into a subduction zone and they're totally recycled and like they become like basement rock of the earth.
It's funny that the idea of humanity in all of its forms, benevolent and otherwise, and malevolent, all those forms, that the idea of them being swallowed up is solace and comfort to you. And I think that concept brings great anxiety to many.
I think so. I think the idea of the end of the finite is really scary and overwhelming. And I think the reason that I believe anyways, the reason why people are so terrified of that is because life is actually really beautiful and wonderful and nobody wants to let go of it. You know, and the idea of having to give it up is just like so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Which is why these corporate motherfuckers need to go down. I'm so sorry. You can delete that.
Nope, it's staying in.
No, but seriously, they need to knock it off. It's horrifying.
It is. This is kind of an interesting time too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been really wonderful to watch. I don't adhere to any political belief system, but it's been wonderful to watch how the things that, at least United States, at the things that everyone are relying on right now are the gifts of socialism, you know, whereas we're looking at economic relief ubiquitously for everyone, rolling people into mm-hmm. healthcare instead of kicking them off. Those are all equitable, semi-socialist, if not purely socialist behaviors. And it's just been like, I just don't understand how at least the federal government can sit around right now and say that socialism is to be feared and abhorred and avoided at all costs when those are the very things that they are doing right now to save people's lives and to save people's livelihoods. And I don't know. It's the great irony.
It does seem like people are getting a really, there are a lot of complicated, especially with the coronavirus, like you're mentioning, it's a really interesting time in which the role of federal government versus local municipal governments and where one person's individual right ends and someone else's begins and sort of the benefits of the community over the individual. There's a lot of actually highly complex issues going on at the moment that are sort of being played out. And it's fascinating to see on a political level and then on a community level.
Yeah. The power of community and your local government right now seems to be really mattering the most, which has been nice. And I, at least maybe I feel good about that because living in Portland, I feel like we have a pretty good team in our local government that are doing the right things right now to protect its people. Mm-hmm. In Multnomah County, the county that I live in, we're one of the only counties in the state that hasn't applied from the state governor to reopen yet because the county just has the highest number of infections and they've decided that that it's more important to just stay home, have everyone shelter in place and wait it out, despite the tremendous social push from everyone around the country to reopen. So I'm grateful for them. I know that they're making plans to reopen soon here, but I'm grateful for their insistence on waiting rather than launching headfirst into disaster.
Absolutely. And speaking of which, this it affects your work too, because you've taken on a teaching role or a sort of a leadership guidance role with a group called, which is how I initially learned about you, called Wildcraft.
Yeah, so I'm one of their expedition leaders, and I lead rock hounding trips through Wildcraft Studio, and they're so fun. I think I've led about 12 trips now through them.
Tell me a little bit about an ordinary trip, so our listeners can understand what kind of trips you guide and lead and what it is that you do.
A normal trip lasts about 3 days. We do 2 nights of camping. The group gathers together close to the area where we will be rock hounding on the first day. And it's usually pretty far away from the cities that most people travel from for these trips, which is Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, sometimes LA folks. And they're always desert trips. I used to do coastal trips, but we got rained on one too many times. A river flooded once and our rock hounding spots disappeared. You know, too many heartbreaks for the coastal trips. So now I only do desert trips. I do them through Eastern Oregon. I take anywhere from 12 to 20 folks out. They used to be women only trips, but that distinction actually stopped mattering to me a couple years ago. And we started inviting anyone to come on the trips, and it turned out to feel totally the same. It didn't feel any different. It was lovely. We camp out usually by hot springs if we can, in the evenings. During the day, we go to a couple rock hounding spots. The trips are conducted road trip style, and so we do cover a lot of ground on the trips as well. So sometimes there's a couple hours of driving during the day. But it's always worth it because the places that we go to are extraordinary. I always take people to sites where material is plentiful so that there's no heartbreak. There are some amazing rock hounding spots on the route in our trips that I often skip over because the chances of everyone finding something good are really low. You know, these are places where I stop often when I'm traveling through, and most of the time I don't find good stuff, but once in a while I'll find something incredible. But that's not a gamble that I'm interested in taking when I design these trips. What I really want is abundance. Also, I have a responsibility of taking larger groups to these rock hunting areas, of not clearing them out of the good material, which happens when rock clubs take big groups out to places. And so I really do like to only go to places of abundance. That way, even if we take a lot of rocks, you would never know we were there because there's still tons of material left over. So that's kind of ethically my goal. But yeah, we do lots of hiking around and exploring dry washes and canyons, abandoned mines, weird old volcanic eruptions. We tend to spend a lot of time in volcanic calderas, like super huge Yellowstone size explosions, because there's always the best rock and mineral material there, but also there's usually geothermal activity, which means hot springs. So you kind of get like the 2-for-1 deal, which is pretty sweet. Oregon is very rich in volcanic calderas, so that's pretty nice.
And so did you imagine this, I guess it was 7 years ago, you said, when you started diving in a little bit deeper, did you imagine that you would not only be as involved as you are, but be a leader in the community?
No, God, no. No, definitely not. And I still feel very wary of having any claim to leadership in my rock world. I definitely still feel very new to it. And the rock hounding trips were never my idea, actually. Chelsea Hefner, who runs Wildcraft School, came to me with the idea, and I didn't even know her. And at first, I said no. I said no. I'd only been rock hounding for about 2 years at that point, like seriously rock hounding. And I just felt like way too green to have the responsibility of making sure people found cool stuff. But she was very persistent and wrote to me a couple times and convinced me to do it. And I remember my first trip, I was so nervous. I was so nervous because I felt such a huge responsibility to make sure everybody stayed safe, that everybody found cool stuff, and that everybody had a good time the whole time and was comfortable. We were backcountry camping with no toilets or anything like that, no showers. And I just didn't know how the group would respond. And everybody had so much fun. And it was such a good group. And everyone found so much cool stuff. There was even this like very young, handsome park ranger that materialized out of nowhere and followed our group of women for a little bit. And all the ladies loved him so much. Somebody even got his phone number. Like, I kind of asked for like a better, like just in case one person wasn't actually having a good time, the sexy park ranger, like really, I was just like, who is this angel? Thank you for showing up, you know, grabbing that last person who maybe was unsure if they liked, you know, snake-filled deserts.
Well, you think that it's the reverse too. I mean, he comes across this group of women in the desert thinking every other day is just the same over and over again.
Yeah.
But wow, this is really an upgrade.
Yeah. Oh yeah. He got a lot of attention. That night around the campfire, the gals came up with a matchmaking app called Arrange Arranger. so that anybody could find themselves a sexy park ranger to date. So but yeah, it's funny. Now that I've led about 12 trips, I still go on every trip feeling the same amount of nervousness. Not worrying. I don't worry about anyone's safety anymore. I don't worry about anybody not finding cool stuff. Like, those for me are guaranteed. But I still feel so nervous because I want everybody to have the best time and I want it so bad, you know. I feel like by now I should know that everybody's going to have a really good time, but sometimes you just can't shake those nerves, you know. You still just like really want to make sure everything is so fun the whole time, nonstop.
Well, and even times when there's a little bit of trial can be an important experience for people too. You know, even if it's an overall good experience and there are some hard moments, that might be a good thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I've definitely had things happen on trips that didn't go right. Like when we did a coast trip and we were rock hounding in the coastal rivers on the Oregon coast, and there was intense flooding, and every single one of our rock hounding spots was flooded. There was just no rocks. They were totally underwater, deep water. And everyone rolled with the punches, and we just ended up going to the beaches and like laying in the sand and gossiping for the weekend. And it wasn't the point of the trip, but everybody still had a really good time, and it ended up being really fun. And last year on my desert trip, we ended up having very severe thunderstorms on the second night that were pretty scary. And they were happening right over our tent area. And I was feeling really nervous about it, but nobody else came off or expressed any nervousness whatsoever. People were so into it. Everyone just huddled in their tents. A couple people got in their cars and we waited the storms out. We didn't end up eating dinner together until 10 p.m. and it was totally fine. Everybody loved it. People got amazing photographs of the thunder clouds and the rainbows and the lightning, and everyone was oohing and aahing, and I'm sitting there like, oh no, I can't believe this. This is horrible. And everyone's like, wow, this is amazing. And I'm like, oh God, oh no.
I mean, that just sounds like a stunning sight to behold. I'm sure people were thrilled, even if they weren't.
It was one of the more beautiful storms I've gotten to witness in my life. I think that when you are the point person for the experience, I think that you just feel so much responsibility. So whereas like thunderstorms and flooded rivers, no big deal for anybody else. For me, I'm just like, I can't believe this is happening. Why?
I think that's the pressure of being a leader. It is a really difficult position.
Yeah, yeah. I think, and I think that maybe it's a good thing that I'm constantly keeping my eye out for making sure everything runs smoothly and is really good. I definitely have been on trips in my life with leaders or guides who were clearly very complacent about their job, and I didn't feel safe with them. And so I definitely don't ever want to be that kind of trip guide, for sure.
Right, like you lose, yeah, people feel uncomfortable because of your cavalier approach to the
totally.
Whole thing.
And I think an important detail I should mention is that the places I take people are places that I know really, really well. I know these places very intimately. I've spent tons of time with them. So I'm never taking people to places that I don't know where we could encounter, you know, a serious danger and I would not know our way out of an area or anything like that. This is my second home, really. And I love being in these places. I think it's more just dealing with those other smaller unexpected things, you know. Weather, sure. Really. Weather has been my nemesis in being a trip guide, for sure. It's always, anytime we've had drama on expeditions, it's just weather. And we deal with it. And everybody comes prepared, and so nobody gets rained on, etc. Everybody has what they need. So it's always ended up being fine.
And so probably for the best way to get a sense of these landscapes is truly to go to your Instagram account, which is at Allison Jean Cole. But could you describe some of these landscapes? I mean, you said Southeast Desert of Oregon and some other areas, but can you just kind of describe the landscape and the geology there a bit?
Sure. So for my guided trips, we do Central Oregon and we do Southeast Oregon along the Nevada border. I spend a lot of time in Nevada and Southern California. Once in a while, I get out to Arizona or New Mexico or Utah. But Southeastern Oregon is my favorite desert for sure. And I think what I love about it so much is that the entire Southeast zone is the path of a historic, giant, deep earth hotspot. If you draw a line from Southeast Oregon, kind of where, almost where California, Nevada, and Oregon meet, to where Yellowstone National Park is right now, that line is the path of a hotspot, which is a massive amount of molten rock. Well, not molten, but soft, buoyant rock welling up from really deep in the earth, resulting in these massive explosions, like an explosion the size of Rhode Island, you know, not like the crater top of Mount St. Helens blowing off, like a whole state exploding. Wow. Super massive explosions. And you can see the path. If you look at a satellite map, you can trace that path. That path's been interrupted by geology in the meantime, things moving around. It's not pure, but you can tell. Anyone can tell. And the great thing about calderas is that they leave this incredible craggy landscape behind, very, very otherworldly. And that whole landscape is covered in super hot welded ash that's really high in silica. And the magic of silica is that it loves to preserve anything it lands on. So wherever you have calderas, you have beautiful fossils, especially plants. So you can find beautiful leaf fossils in Southeast Oregon, petrified wood for days, agate and jasper, which are just pure silica that was once a silica tea, like a fluid, and then it hardens and crystallizes into a very dense, very colorful, beautiful patterned material. And then you have opal, precious opal, fire opal, which are translucent stones that have Schiller and flash in them. And you get crazy rhyolites. Sometimes you get obsidians, lots of obsidian, which is really fun. And sometimes obsidian can be really colorful too. It's not always black. It's just kind of endless. And you get all these cool volcanic formations and you get all this. You don't necessarily get geothermal activity like hot springs in the site of an old caldera unless something is happening that is allowing that hot water to get back up. In a new caldera like Yellowstone, which is where the hot spot is now, you definitely have geothermal activity. You have a lot of hot water coming to the surface, boiling, dropping all sorts of weird, soft ions and metals, and you get those cool, like, rainbow colors around the geysers. But what's happening in Southeast Oregon is that there's another thing. The caldera kind of path followed that hot spot along, but you have rifting happening. It's called basin and range rifting, and it's the largest rifting zone on the planet. And if you were to look at a satellite map of mostly Nevada, you'll just see all of these north to south trending skinny mountain ranges, one after another, boom, 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 boom. And if you look up into Southeast Oregon, they continue up into Southeast Oregon. They go all the way down into Southern California, Arizona, New Mexico, a little bit into Utah. And the Earth is literally the crust, the North American plate, is just pulling apart. And those little mountain ranges are all the cracks. And basin and range rifting is happening underneath Southeast Oregon. So what you have is these ancient calderas being ripped apart by basin and range rifting, exposing all of these crazy ash layers filled with fossils and gemstones, and they're everywhere. And so it is just like the best place to go rock hounding. It's so fun. And you can find all sorts of rocks too. The variety is endless. There's even an abandoned mine that we visit on the Sunstones and Hot Springs trip that's an old copper mine. And there's beautiful, like neon greenish blue chrysocolla sitting all over the ground. It's just right there. You just drive right up to it and it's, you know, as far as the eye can see, it's so fun. So I really love it.
That just sounds magical.
I think I worry sometimes that I speak in hyperbole about this, but I have to say that it really is true. Everything that I'm saying, it's true. These things are happening. They're there. I think that I am blessed with the gift of understanding the geology behind it a little bit. And so that helps me see its magic a lot more. And I think that coming to geologic understandings of places can only result in feeling magic. I'm convinced of that. And so for me, rock hounding is always a magical experience.
And how much more intimate is it to understand how things came to be?
I think in terms of understanding geologic stories is that you have to be willing to believe in a moving target as well, because geologic understanding and formation histories are always changing or improving or being totally obliterated and canceled. You know, like in the 60s, people still didn't even believe in plate tectonics at all. It was laughed at. You know, so a lot of geologic theory that I believe in right now is still actually pretty new and fresh. And so I do have to take my understandings also with not so much a grain of salt, but a little bit of levity, being like, this is the story that I believe in right now, but this is a story that could also really change. But it will only become more interesting. It will never become more boring. But yeah, I'm definitely, for me, I'm obsessed with earth processes at the crest, about how crust moves and changes. And so when I'm in these places, I very much imagine what they looked like when they were forming. Like the layer that I'm walking through, I imagine what the surface was like when that layer was actively being created. And so I definitely do personally a lot of like time traveling in my head and visualizing, like hardcore imagining. But also, geologists don't do a very good job of sharing those stories with the general public very well. They tend to baby these stories down to a point where the narrative about the geology is actually just wrong. It's not even correct anymore, because I don't think they trust that people are very curious and smart and are willing to wrap their head around kind of a complex idea. I am very willing to believe that people can wrap their head around a complex idea. It just means they're willing to sit and listen for a little while. I have to do a lot of research on the places that I go, and I have to wade through a lot of really boring scientific papers that are very isolating, is not the word, but what is the word when you're confronted by information or a type of learning that is a little bit difficult and
inaccessible.
Esoteric. And I don't know. When you feel that you've been like left out of a type of information because it hasn't been made accessible to you. But so, yeah. So for me, I've had to do a lot of translating. Luckily, I have a background in the sciences, so I can read a scientific paper. I don't want to. They're so boring. They're awful. Nobody who writes them likes writing them. Ever in the history, why we haven't changed the model of writing papers, I don't know. I guess people are really hung up on being so careful about their research. you know, and the components of scientific papers matters, but I still think that the language is archaic. I think that you can write a scientific paper and also be human at the same time. But
have you ever thought about writing that said paper?
No, but I have thought about writing a rock hounding book a lot. I've thought about it a lot. Most rock hounding books are written by men, and I'm going to go out on a sexist limb here and say that most rock hounding books written by men are really about giving you directions to a rock hounding site and a short description of the site. But because they're written by men, the directions are so bad, always really bad directions. And you're writing a book on directions. It's infuriating. Oh my God. Yeah. Just like, somebody get a woman on this.
It sounds like you might have a project calling you.
I do. I think right now what I've been weighing is, do I self-publish or do I try to find a publisher? And if I find a publisher, is that actually even a good idea anymore? But if I find a publisher, I'd want them to be a really decent sized publisher with a large distribution so that it would be worth my time, you know, to profit share and to go through their standards of publishing instead of doing like my own like folksy spelling error kind of stuff that I'm currently doing.
Because you have some information or some content now through a zine that you do called, what is it?
Thunder Egg. Yeah. So Thunder Egg is a rock hounding zine. I've done 2 issues. I've published it once a year for the last 2 years. In the first zine, I wrote an entry, but in the second zine, I didn't write an entry at all. I just wanted it to be other people. Mm-hmm. But with Thunder Egg, it's more like culture rather than rock hounding. You know, there's no directions to any sites. Most of the entries are not necessarily site specific. It's more about like, I went rock hounding and this happened to me, or my life with this specific rock, or, you know, or poetry. It's a little bit more abstract. But I'd love to write a rock hounding book. I think it would be good.
I think it'd be fascinating, especially because I love reading your Instagram posts, because I don't have a background in the sciences, but it's like reading another language. And then the more, you know, you can gloss through them, or if you actually pay attention, it becomes a story. It becomes full and rich and much more interesting if you kind of dive into it. And I noticed that on some of your posts, you actually have waypoints listed for location points. What is the etiquette around sharing those in the rock community? What is that like?
Oh, it's so controversial. Mm-hmm. It really is. Which is ironic because at least in the culture of rock clubs, the point is sharing. It's all about sharing information. But with a lot of rock hounds, they're very secretive about the places where they go rock hounding, especially if they find something good. They don't want anyone else to know about it because they'd like to return continually and take all of it if they can. And rock hounds can only take a truck out with them, so they can only fill a truckload up when they leave and rocks are heavy. So people really want to protect sites. The best way to protect a site is to stake a claim on it if it's on public land, which most land in the West is. And staking a claim, as long as you own under 10 claims a year, it's like $15 to own a claim for a year, which means it's public land, but you and you exclusively have the right to take rocks from it. You can even live on it for free. $15 a year. It's crazy. It's the mining law of like 1847 or something like that spurred the gold rush. But I love to share coordinates. I'm a firm believer in sharing. I hate these ideas of secrecy around rock hounding because I think it's largely promoted by white people who are practicing colonial behavior on stolen indigenous land. It's not your land. Don't keep it a secret. If you're going to go take from it, don't take too much, but don't claim that it's yours. You know, it's just like, I just think it is the promulgation of like really bad white colonial behavior, and I'm so over it. It's boring, you know? Like, let's share. Sharing and openness creates a more sharing and open society in which everyone wins. So in any way that you can practice sharing in your life, there's no harm in that. I don't know. I think about this a lot.
Do you think it's controversial because people are protective of the land itself, or is it a more sort of self-centered concern that they just don't want it sort of scooped up by other people? They want it for themselves.
Well, oh yeah, my girlfriend in the background is saying rock hounds are hoarders, which is true. Most rock hounds are hoarders. I am very lucky in that I'm not a hoarder. I have a 2-bucket rule. I have 2 5-gallon buckets worth of rocks in my life at any given time, and that's it. I have a very small indoor collection of rocks, very small, could fit in a box. So why is it controversial to share? So any coordinates that I have ever shared on social media are places that I've gotten to in a car. So they're not sensitive wilderness areas that have like an extremely rare wildflower that no one has ever seen, you know? They are wild spaces, but they are not true wilderness areas as conservation organizations categorize them. If I can get to it, you can get to it. And I think it's really funny, like, especially I've noticed this around hot springs on social media. Whenever somebody posts a picture of a hot springs and shares where it is, there's always like endless angry comments in the feed. You know, you're going to blow the place up. Don't share. You're such a jerk for sharing. Now this place is going to get overrun. And it's like, well, if you are already there and they are already there, it's not a secret. And to keep it a secret from other people doesn't make you a conservationist. It makes you an elitist. These are all places people can get to in cars. They're on the side of a road. Like, please, for the love of God, knock it off. And if you don't want people to know about a place and you do want to keep it a secret, do not post about it on social media. Like, it's that simple. Right. Just don't brag about it, you know? Oh, it drives me crazy. It really drives me crazy. I truly believe in sharing. And honestly, like, if you look like NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has a public map on the internet that is very easy to find of every single hot water source in the country. Anywhere where hot water comes up through the surface of the ground, a hot spring, it's on the map. Like, all you need to do is go look at that map. Every hot spring in North America is on it. Like, there's no like secret about hot springs. They're a geothermal resource. They're very well mapped. None of them are actually a secret to any, I just really struggle with these weird ideas about like backcountry secrecy. I think that if you're going to go spend, if you really want to get to remote locations, go backpacking, you know, and go off the trail too. Like, become really good at wayfinding, practice your GPS skills, practice your trail marking skills, and really get out there. And then don't post about it on the internet.
Right. One of the other slightly controversial things that I heard a little bit about in your talking in another interview, and it was just with regard to people wanting to impose sort of metaphysical qualities on the rocks, where you were saying that you were much more interested in the geologic properties.
Oh, yeah, sure. So I'm a firm believer in rock magic, but the magic for me is in the formation story and how it came to be. Because the rock will tell you its formation story. You know, all you have to do is observe it and know a little bit about geology to understand the history of the stone and the material. And it's just so fascinating. It's endlessly fascinating and like very uplifting and beautiful and meaningful to think on geologic time. I think my trouble with metaphysical properties and stones is that those are stories that are imposed on the stone by humanity. Those are human stories that are inward gazing. You know, it's not about what happened to this rock that it got here. It's about how will this rock improve me spiritually and make me better. And I know that those symbologies are actually really meaningful to people and that they can be really helpful in times of trouble or of hardship or of conflict. And so I'm not down on metaphysics and in metaphysical qualities of rocks. I just can't tell you anything about the metaphysical qualities of rocks because I don't know anything about it. It's not part of my belief strategy for coping with my humanity. But I would love to talk about the formation story of the stone. I just think that that's where the beauty is.
So when it comes to when you're not doing trips where you're leading and you're not going with the rock hounding group, so is your girlfriend also a lapidary, or do you guys go on trips together? Like, how do you plan a trip and what goes into that process and how do you know where you want to go?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think I try to get my girlfriend to come out on as many trips with me as she can. She is not a lapidary. She's also an artist. She mostly does kind of large scale installation work, but she also works as an art director in film and TV. And so a lot of times Lisa will be working on a job and will just be totally consumed by it and unavailable. But when she's not working, she definitely comes on the rock trips, which is ideal because she has a better rock hounding eye than I do and always finds better things and really good things. So it's kind of like an ace in the hole to have Lisa along rock hounding, and she loves it. Most rock hounding trips I plan with my rock hounding friends. A lot of times I'll go out with people in my club on informal trips. It's not a club sanctioned trip. We'll just go out together in usually Central Oregon for a couple days, you know, campfires, rock hounding, swimming, being lazy, drinking beer by noon, you know, fun, general fun. But then once a year I do a really epic trip that's usually lasts 10 days to 2 weeks with my friend Charlie. And sometimes it's just me, Charlie, and Lisa. And sometimes it's me, Charlie, and 14 other people, and some of them are strangers. But it's called Notable Holes, and we go looking for holes through various desert biomes, mostly Nevada, but sometimes Southern California. We're hoping to get into Utah and Arizona and New Mexico on future trips. The holes can be anything. So they can be calderas, they can be craters, they can be nuclear bomb craters, they can be wells, they can be abandoned mines, they can be missing places, you know, a hole in history. And we kind of draft up an itinerary together collaboratively on Google Maps, and then we drive it. And it's usually all on dirt roads, pretty out of the way places, and yeah, do some like fun, wacky art projects along the way. But yeah, Notable Holes. The first year we were very ambitious and even made a zine for it. Like had like lectures and stuff. But the second year that kind of fell apart and we're like, let's just go drive and see if we can find these holes.
What are some of the wacky art projects that you've undertaken on these trips?
So on one of the trips, I personally collected as many fluorescent rocks as I could, which are rocks that glow under UV light. In darkness. And I tried to make like a ground sculpture out of these fluorescent rocks. But what I discovered, it didn't work very well, is that my fluorescent light, my portable one that I brought with me, would definitely make them fluoresce, but I couldn't work at a large enough scale for the light to light them all up and get a photograph. So it was kind of like a good in theory, bad in execution art project.
Great idea though.
We've definitely done some like stupid little funny performances with found garbage. Like we go to a lot of abandoned mines where there's a lot of weird metal shit lying all over the ground. And we've definitely like definitely created a lot of weird sculptures and left them behind. Definitely like filmed ourselves doing like weird little 2-minute performances with trash. I don't know. It's all just like very impromptu and in the moment and silly. But it's fun. It's definitely fun.
That's the real joy though, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we clean up after ourselves. We don't leave any of the piled rocks that everybody gets so upset about these days, which I just learned was a thing people got upset about was the rock stacking, the cairns.
Oh, why is that controversial?
I think it's more controversial on real trails, like actual hiking trails or mountain biking trails in national parks, where people are stacking rocks to either mark trails better or just stacking rocks for fun. I think it's become, I'm not totally in the loop about this, but I think it's become a social media thing where people, when they go out in nature, they make a stack of rocks and they take a picture of it. Like, it's just one of those weird things that people are doing. So now there's kind of an army of nature lovers who hate the rock stackers and will post pictures of the stacked rocks and complain about them and then talk about how they took them apart. And like a lot of national park rangers go out specifically to dismantle cairns, stacked rocks. Mm-hmm. They claim that it's destructive. And I think that it probably is. If you have an area with not a whole lot of rocks and then everyone is picking them up and stacking them, you know, it's just like messing with small ground biomes.
That's interesting because I never thought of it as I have seen that on social media before, but I never thought of it in primarily as a social media phenomenon. I've always seen that or interpreted that as, like you said earlier, trying to better identify trail marks and trail directions so that people stay on the trail and don't further upset the ecosystem by getting off trail, getting lost.
Totally.
And so I always thought of it as sort of more of a something that was more beneficial. Than it was, you know, problematic.
Yeah, and I think that making cairns or stacked rocks for trail marking is, you know, is an ancient tradition and it's long been used on trail systems everywhere. I think what was explained to me by the person that was very upset with me I made like a little diary of funny stacked rock photos that I found on the internet and posted them as like a long story. Just because I was finding all these wonderful pictures of funny stacked rocks sculptures.
Sure.
And quite a few people wrote very angry messages to me saying that I was promoting a really destructive habit and that people needed to stop stacking rocks. And I was just like, wow, fascinating. Tell me more. Why is rock stacking bad all of a sudden? So,
right.
So now I know. I think that there's the tradition of rock stacking to mark a trail. But now there's like this thing that everybody does, which is random rock stacking wherever they happen to go. That I think is bad. And I think that there's like the National Park Service is like actively asking people not to stack rocks and stuff. So, but yeah, news to me.
Interesting. That's news to me as well. I was unaware of that. Tell me about, I think I'm saying this correct, Vernal, Utah, and the fossils you found. I read something about that as well. It sounds like you surprised yourself with an interesting find.
Oh, see, that's why it's so good to bring Lisa rock hounding. So last summer, Lisa was working on a TV show that was filming in the Wasatch Range in Utah. And so we went to go live there for the summer. And on the weekends when she was free, we would just do like really quick little, you know, rock hounding trips, just camping for one night. And we went out to Vernal, which we had never been out there before. And I highly recommend it to anyone passing through. It's home to Dinosaur National Monument, which is a very famous dinosaur bone site. There's also lots of pre-colonial ruins and petroglyphs and rock art out there. And there's this endless zone of badlands, these beautiful melting colorful striped hills south of Vernal, and that's where we went out to the badlands. We went out to this place called Fantasy Canyon, which is not really a canyon. It's just these very strange sandstone concretions that look like Rorschach blotch prints painting.
Rorschach,
yeah. Very cool. And then we just went up into the Badlands kind of way out way, way, way out and just camped. The tragic thing about that corner of Utah is it's one of the largest petroleum reserves on the planet and is also one of the largest oil fields on the planet, and nobody knows about it. And it goes on forever, but it just doesn't touch any large towns. It's south of Vernal and goes all the way down to Moab, essentially. And it runs through an indigenous reservation, the Ouray Reservation. But yeah, we went out through these badlands. Sorry, I'm really dragging this out. We camped in this little cove of badlands, about as far away from anything as we could get, behind an oil pump, behind a derrick. And the mosquitoes and midges were awful. They were so brutal, we couldn't even handle being out of the car. But it was so hot out, so we decided to just take a quick beer walk, and then we would just sit in the car for the rest of the night. We were sleeping in the truck. We didn't have a tent with us. And we just walked back into this little kind of muddish slot canyon, and Lisa picked something up off the ground and said, "This is a dinosaur bone." And I said, "No, it's not." And she said, "Yes, it is." And then we just looked, and in the wall next to us was like a skull sticking out of the wall.
Oh my gosh.
And then we started looking on the ground some more, and there were bones everywhere, everywhere.
Wow.
And there was also petrified wood everywhere. And there was all sorts of stuff. And so we ended up just burying the bugs for as long as we could. We didn't take any of the bones. It is forbidden to collect vertebrate bones on public land unless you have a paleontology permit. So we took pictures of all of the bones and sent them to the local paleontologists in Vernal. And to make a very long story short, I ended up having to contact every paleontologist in Utah and then some even outside Utah before I could find a taker. The local paleontologists weren't interested. But then because I had contacted every paleontologist in the West, basically, word was getting around about the bones and the pictures were getting around, and suddenly the local paleontologists were interested. And then COVID-19 happened and a mandate was about to come down the line saying no field work. And so the local Vernal paleontologists went out there and dug them up.
Oh my gosh.
Before anybody else could.
How do you think they disregarded it at first?
Because we had just found fragments and there was no sign that we had found full skeleton. And, you know, the pictures I sent them were good, were clear, but didn't give them a sense of how much stuff was actually out there. It was just like the five pictures that I took. And so I think that it was more word getting around, and I finally got a taker. This paleontologist in Arizona was really excited to dig them up. And I think that word got around that the Vernal people probably should have taken us up on it in the beginning. And so... so they finally did, which I'm so happy about. I don't care who digs it up. I'm just really happy that they were collected. And it turns out Lisa had found two different species of giant turtle. One of them was almost complete, and plus some various other vertebrate bones. They weren't dinosaur bones. They were actually post-dinosaur. So it was mammal bones and giant turtle bones from about 30 to 50 million years ago.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
They haven't cleaned them up yet, but they promised to send us pictures when they finally do. And I am just so excited. I'm really excited.
So when you say giant turtle, like what's your guess on how big these turtles are?
You know, like a round kitchen table that four chairs sit at?
Uh-huh. Wow.
Like that big.
Oh my gosh. That is wild.
Yeah. And they got a lot bigger than that. Some of them got to be the size of like VW bugs.
Oh my gosh.
But I don't think we found one that big. That would have been pretty cool. But yeah, so.
It's shocking to me that the local paleontologist wasn't all over that. I mean, it's their life's work. So regardless of how small the find is, don't you think that would still be compelling enough to get you out there?
Here's the thing, and I've been thinking about this a lot. I think that they live in paleontological abundance out there. Fossil vertebrate bones are everywhere. They really are. They're very easy to find. Utah is dinosaur paradise, mammal paradise, you name it, you can dig it up. And I think that probably a lot of people find little bits of bone and send it to them. And they're like, yes, of course, we know there's bones everywhere. Thank you very much. Have a nice day. But I think I'm lucky in that I know a lot of paleontologists in Utah. I didn't know the Vernal folks, but I know their bosses. And so I think what happened is I got in touch with their bosses and other people in the community. And I think because other people that they take seriously were being contacted by me and were showing interest, they were like, oh, maybe this isn't just some hokey rock hound sending us pictures of crushed up bone fragments. Like, maybe this person thinks that this is actually worth looking into. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what happened. I think also one thing I've learned, I work with a lot of paleontologists in the state of Utah each year. I run a rock and mineral festival out of the town of Green River, which is actually really a dinosaur festival. All the paleontologists come and lead field trips to their dig sites for families. And so I know a lot of them very well. And what I've learned is that it's not that these paleontologists don't want to go dig it up. It's that very, very little of their paycheck allows them to do that. Like, the good majority of their jobs require them to stay in the office and do administrative work. And so they're only allowed to do so much field work. And so they're really only going to save that field work time for something extraordinary. And so when they get emails from people like me that are like, I found some bones. Oh my God. You know, they're like, that's nice. But I'm juggling 8 different really crucial dig sites that really matter to science. I'm sorry, but I can't go also dig up yours. So I feel bad that I painted the picture that they didn't care. I think that it's not that deep down inside they didn't care. I just think that in terms of the structure of the way those jobs are, it's that their hands are kind of tied, honestly.
That makes sense, actually. That seems actually fairly reasonable.
Yeah, yeah. It was definitely like very drawn out. The whole process took like 8 or 9 months from us finding them to them actually digging them up. But it was very dramatic. Like, all my emails with all the paleontologists were so funny. There was like, at one point, one of them accidentally copied me on like a snide reply about how they didn't care about the bones that they were trying to send to some of the other paleontologists.
Oh,
that's why I'm just like, okay, at least one person in this group did not care.
Yeah. Oh my God.
But yeah, it was fun. I'm just so happy they went and got them. Also, I think there some people might be of a mind, well, like, why does everything have to get dug up? Why can't you just leave it in the ground? But the truth is that this was a site of extreme and fast erosion, and all of these bones were already falling out of the hills and just getting washed downstream, and you would never be able to reassemble them, and they would eventually just erode out of these soft mud hills. Also, the spot where we found them, there were a lot of bullet casings and a lot of trash. We weren't the first people to find this very remote dead end. I think people like, especially people who like to shoot guns, are really good at finding dead ends. And if you find a dead end in the desert, you're going to find bullet casings and trash. So, you know, I was also thinking, like, somebody's going to know these are bones and they're just going to take them. So I decided to report the find.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was like really fun and exciting.
That's very exciting. I mean, I don't imagine that's something that happens every time. That's a pretty big experience.
No, and you know, like, everywhere where I go, people have been before. The geology is really well documented, and there's not a whole lot of discovery left on the surface of the earth. All the discovery happening in geology right now is below the surface, like the mantle and the core.
I just can't even imagine how I have very little concept for what 50 million years ago is. But
I think it was pretty rough. You know, you just had at 65 million years, you had this massive extinction in which all of the large dinosaurs disappear from the face of the earth. A lot of the early mammals disappeared. A lot of insects and plants. A lot of stuff just ceased to exist. And mm-hmm. so I think you kind of have this very slow rebuilding. But by 50 million years, you have some very giant mammals. And that's exciting. That's like some pretty rapid speciation, if I may use the word.
So in a sense, although it doesn't seem like it, you know, 50 million years after that grand extinction, it's still sort of young, so to speak.
Yeah, you've got like 15 to 20 million years of time between like a massive, massive extinction event, of which people still don't really understand. A lot of people think it was a giant meteor that created the Gulf of Mexico. Like, if have you heard about that?
Mm-mm, tell me more.
So if you look at a map of the Earth and you find the Gulf of Mexico, if you trace it with your finger, for the most part, it's almost a perfect circle. It's a massive, massive impact crater. The Yucatan Peninsula kind of messes it up and juts into it, but that's because there's a lot of tectonic activity happening in the Caribbean Ocean and moving stuff around. But so yeah, so that's, I think it's the largest visible impact crater on the surface of the Earth is the Gulf of Mexico. There's a lot of theories that that caused mass extinctions. Then there's these really interesting ideas about flood basalts. Like India, most of India is covered in this thick layer of basalt that happened relatively all at once. Most of Washington and Oregon and Idaho are covered in a very thick layer of thick basalt that kind of happened all at once. And if you could just imagine like the earth literally cracking open and molten rock just pouring out, but pouring out so much that it leaves a layer a few hundred feet thick, maybe even more than that, that covers many states.
Wow.
You know, just like, and that would have been pretty catastrophic and also changed the atmosphere a lot too. So there's these really interesting ideas about what has to happen so quickly to radically alter life everywhere on the planet.
Jeez.
Yeah, very exciting. I'm really interested in this flood basalts theory. Because it's kind of new and I didn't learn about it when I was in school. I only learned about the Yucatan impact, the Gulf of Mexico crater.
What about it intrigues you?
Well, it just seems like it's not so much flood basalts doing damage once they got to the surface. I'm just more of the mind of like, how can the earth crack open so suddenly and just completely spill out all its guts like that? Because there's so much tension on all of the plates that cover the surface of the earth that I can't imagine any of them just having enough room to just magically part ways so quickly without that rupture being solidified and just closed again, healed, you know? I just don't know enough about rifting to understand flood basalts, and I just don't understand how that much material can just flood the surface of the earth, because evidence everywhere else on the globe would suggest that that scenario is very unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
You have most of India and you have the Pacific Northwest that say, like, actually, no, this can happen.
Is this a newly widely accepted theory, or is it still sort of a minority?
Well, the theory is accepted because the proof is there. Like, there are all of Oregon and Washington, not all of Oregon, but most of Oregon and Washington and most of India are covered by this ubiquitous, clearly formed at the same time blanket of basalt. I mean, I should be clear, it wasn't a single event. It was multiple events over time. But the time window in geology, so close together that you can think of it in geologic history as one event. But it was like waves of basalt rolling through. I think things that really get to me in science are when I'm learning about something either in a class. I try to take classes as much as I can, even though I'm not an enrolled student anywhere. I find my way in. Where a teacher will discuss a really significant geologic formation, but never discuss the formation history or why it happened. And then when you ask about it, they just say, oh, we don't know. And I'm just like, that is not a good enough answer. That is an insufficient answer. Like, your whole point of existence is to be a geologist, and you're telling me right now you don't care to have an imagination about how this is possible. You are failing me. So, yeah.
I wonder if that's part of the paradigm, though, that people feel really uncomfortable postulating in any way that would require an imagination to sort of flesh something out, because it's sort of the medium, the scientific medium. Like, people want it, it requires a certain empirical evidence in to be tested and tried before people are really willing to stand mm-hmm. behind it at all.
I think that academic scientists and lifelong researchers are very careful in their discussion mm-hmm. of material. I think they are. And I think that that's good. I also think it's boring. but I think that that's also why I'm not a scientist. I think that I don't fit the mold. I think that I'm willing not to be reckless or careless, but maybe, and not cavalier, but maybe I'm just willing to wonder a lot and be wrong and take a stab at it. Yeah, I don't know. I found myself very bored in science when I was working in it. I felt pretty bored.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you found where you're supposed to be, though, now.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I have a lot of freedom to be myself, to be a weirdo, to work for myself. It's really nice. I'm very, very happy with how things have turned out, for sure. If you had told me that this is how things would end up, you know, when I had graduated from college or when I was in my 20s, I probably wouldn't have believed you.
What are some of the life lessons that you've learned in your work?
Oh, wow. I mean, the big thing for me, honestly, is tools and equipment and operating machinery, becoming comfortable with tools, but also understanding the engineering of the tool and how to fix it, which is still something I'm really not good at all. I do a lot of flailing and whining and question asking and Lisa go getting, go get Lisa, because she's very, very, very adept and clever with repairing things and figuring things out. But it's definitely been learning a lot about tools, the magic of tools, what tools enable you to do. I also view my car as a tool, and I definitely, right now I have an older Toyota 4Runner that I love, and before that I had an old Toyota 4x4 pickup truck. But it's about making improvements to those vehicles that allow me to get a little bit farther out, which is really nice, despite the irony of driving a gas guzzler during climate change. I really do love the vehicle, and it's taken me to some of the most extraordinary places that I've ever seen. But yeah, for me, it's been about, and I guess maybe the larger byline through tools and equipment and, you know, big machinery like vehicles and caring for them and not needing to rely on somebody if you get in a pinch, been kind of maybe machining and engineering independence as a woman. Even though I'm not a machinist or an engineer, it's definitely being willing to get down with those things and understand them. Before I got into rock hounding and lapidary work, I was not skilled or capable with anything. I had no hand skills whatsoever. And I was always really embarrassed about that, and it made me feel very self-conscious. Mm-hmm. And I really do believe that women should start writing user manuals exclusively, because I'm so sick of these user manuals that I've been getting with my tool. Oh my God, I'm so mad about it. As you can tell, I'm also very deeply sexist, to a fault. And I apologize to any of your male listeners. Forgive me. But yeah, that to me has been a huge lesson. Freedom through knowledge. Mm-hmm. And skills through hand tools and power tools.
Those are both great ones. Yeah, the ability to work with your hands, or just the ability to wrench on something, to either work with a machine or anything in engineering. Yeah, it's very few women, I think, feel natively comfortable doing it. And whether there's all sorts of potential reasons for that. But yeah, I think that's wonderful that that's something that you've gained a familiarity with.
Yeah, for sure. And I think... the other probably big lesson that I've come away with is, like, it is totally okay to be wrong. And And once you have been called out for being wrong about something, graciously accept the call out and roll with it and learn from it. You know, I felt like in my 20s, coming from a science background, I often found myself being so unwilling to ever be wrong about anything ever.
Mm-hmm.
To a point of just kind of like weird, snooty behavior and insecurity. And the more I learned to roll with the punches and just be able to be like, wow, I was so wrong about that. That's not the way it is at all. Thank you for correcting me. And moving forward has been really awesome. And now I'm totally fine with it because I am usually wrong.
You sound very humble.
Oh gosh, I hope so. Sometimes I worry I'm a little bit of a force, but I'd like to tread lightly if I can.
There's a real grace to being able to say when one is wrong too. It kind of takes the tension and the power out of it, you know, just sort of dismantles it in a way that lets it just be in a way that doesn't really threaten.
Oh, right. I mean, your ego is just like so out to get you all the time. You have to bat it back and just be like, no, dude, it's okay to be wrong. Shut up.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes it's like playing whack-a-mole, you know?
Totally. For me. Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Allison, this has been wonderful. I've learned so much more than I was even anticipating. I knew this was going to be an education, but this has been really fabulous. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for asking really good questions and letting me ramble. I appreciate it.
Oh, that's where the good stuff is. That's the good stuff. Do you have anything you'd like to sort of say as a parting message or anything about maybe some upcoming work or things you'd like to share with the audience? And even if not that, ways that they can stay in touch with your work and your developments?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I really love Instagram a lot. It's been such an awesome platform to meet people who love rocks and minerals too, even though it is also a garbage heap. There are some gems in there. And so I'm always on, and you can follow me at Allison Jean Cole, Allison with one L. Send me a message. I love to chat in the DMs. And if you are a publisher and you would like to publish my rock hunting book, please call me.
Yeah,
let's make a deal.
I really do hope you go through with that book. It sounds like it's much needed.
Yeah, it may be like totally unnecessary and not needed at all, but I still would love to do it, you know? So.
Yeah. Oh, how neat would that be?
Yeah, it'd be great. Thank you so much, Mary. I'm really excited to meet you. I would love to learn more about how you got into this path and the journalism work that you've been doing. It's really interesting.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to meeting you as well and going on one of these trips and just seeing some of this firsthand. It's a whole part of the Pacific Northwest I really haven't explored, so I'm looking forward to it too.
It's real.
And yeah, I mean, this whole project has been, it's really just an excuse to meet wonderful people like you and share the kind of work you're doing that I feel like needs more attention. So thank you for taking the time to tell us about it.
Oh, happy to do it.
Wonderful. Well, I look forward to meeting you in person, and thanks again for your time today.
All right. Take care of yourself. Be safe out there.
Okay. Thanks, Allison. You too.
Bye.